The beach was a long white edging, like a flirt of silk slip at the hem of the bright blue sea, and it was totally empty except for a round object about 70 yards away. This round object was about the size of a basketball, and it filled Ralph with a fear that was both deep and, for the moment at least, groundless. "Don't go near it," he told himself. "There's something bad about it. Something really bad. It's a black dog barking at a blue moon. Blood in the sink. A raven perched on a bust of Pallas just inside my chamber door. You don't want to go near it, Ralph. And you don't need to go near it, because this is one of Joe Wise's lucid dreams. You can just turn and cruise away if you want." Except his feet began to carry him forward anyway. So maybe this wasn't a lucid dream. Not pleasant either, not at all. Because the closer he got to that object on the beach, the less it looked like a basketball. It was by far the most realistic dream Ralph had ever experienced. And the fact that he knew he was dreaming actually seemed to heighten that sense of realism, of lucidity. He could feel the fine loose sand under his bare feet, warm but not hot. He could hear the grinding, rock-throated roar of the incoming waves as they lost their balance and sprawled their way up the lower beach, where the sand glistened like wet tanned skin. Could smell salt and drying seaweed, a strong and tearful smell that reminded him of summer vacations spent at Old Orchard Beach when he was a child. "Hey, old buddy, if you can't change this dream, I think maybe you ought to hit the ejection switch and bail out of it. Wake yourself up, in other words, and right away." He had closed half the distance to the object on the beach, and there was no longer any question about what it was. Not a basketball, but a head. Someone had buried a human being up to the chin in the sand, and, Ralph suddenly realized, the tide was coming in. He didn't bail out. He began to run. As he did, the frothy edge of a wave touched the head. It opened its mouth and began to scream. Even raised in a shriek, Ralph knew that voice at once. It was Carolyn's voice. The froth of another wave ran up the beach and backwashed the hair which had been clinging to the head's wet cheeks. Ralph began to run faster, knowing he was almost certainly going to be too late. The tide was coming in fast. It would drown her long before he could free her buried body from the sand. "You don't have to save her, Ralph. Carolyn's already dead. And it didn't happen on some deserted beach. It happened in room 317 of Derry Home Hospital. You were there with her at the end. And the sound you heard wasn't surf, but sleet hitting the window. Remember?" He remembered, but he ran faster nevertheless, sending puffs of sugary sand out behind him. "You won't ever get to her, though. You know how it is in dreams, don't you? Each thing you rush toward turns into something else. No, that wasn't how the poem went, or was it?" Ralph couldn't be sure. All he clearly remembered now was that it had ended with the narrator running blindly from something deadly. "Glancing over my shoulder, I see its shape," which was hunting him through the woods, hunting him and closing in. Yet he was getting closer to the dark shape on the sand. It wasn't changing into anything else either. And when he fell on his knees before Carolyn, he understood at once why he had not been able to recognize his wife of 45 years, even from a distance. Something was terribly wrong with her aura. It clung to her skin like a filthy dry-cleaning bag. When Ralph's shadow fell on her, Carolyn's eyes rolled up like the eyes of a horse that has shattered its leg going over a high fence. She was breathing in rapid, frightened gasps, and each expulsion of air sent jets of gray-black aura from her nostrils. The tattered balloon string straggling up from the crown of her head was the purple-black of a festering wound. When she opened her mouth to scream again, an unpleasant glowing substance flew from her lips in gummy strings, which disappeared almost as soon as his eyes had registered their existence. "I'll save you, Carol," he shouted. He fell on his knees and began digging at the sand around her like a dog digging up a bone. And as the thought occurred to him, he realized that Rosalie, the early morning scavenger of Harris Avenue, was sitting tiredly behind his screaming wife. It was as if the dog had been summoned by the thought. Rosalie, he saw, was also surrounded by one of those filthy black auras. She had Bill McGovern's missing Panama hat between her paws, and it looked as though she had enjoyed many a good chew on it since it had come into her possession. "So that's where the damn hat went," Ralph thought, then turned back to Carolyn and began to dig even faster. So far he hadn't managed to uncover so much as a single shoulder. "Never mind me," Carolyn screamed at him. "I'm already dead, remember? Watch for the white man tracks, Ralph. The..." A wave, glassy green on the bottom and the curdled white of soapsuds on top, broke less than 10 feet from the beach. It ran up the sand toward them, freezing Ralph's balls with cold water and burying Carolyn's head momentarily in a grit-filled surge of foam. When the wave retreated, Ralph raised his own horror-filled shriek to the indifferent blue sky. The retreating wave had done in seconds what it had taken the radiation treatments almost a month to do. Took her hair, washed her bald, and the crown of her head had begun to bulge at the spot where the blackish balloon string was attached. "Carolyn, no!" he howled, digging even faster. The sand was now dank and unpleasantly heavy. "Never mind," she said. Gray-black puffs came from her mouth with each word, like dirty vapor from an industrial smokestack. "It's just the tumor, and it's inoperable, so don't lose any sleep over that part of the show. What the hell, it's a long walk back to Eden, so don't sweat the small stuff, right? But you have to keep an eye out for those tracks." "Carolyn, I don't know what you're talking about." Another wave came, wetting Ralph to the waist and inundating Carolyn again. When it withdrew, the swelling on the crown of her head was beginning to split open. "You'll find out soon enough," Carolyn replied, and then the swelling on her head popped with a sound like a hammer striking a slab of meat. A haze of blood flew into the clear, salt-smelling air, and a horde of black bugs, the size of cockroaches, came pouring out of her. Ralph had never seen anything like them before, not even in a dream, and they filled him with an almost hysterical loathing. He would have fled, Carolyn or not, but he was frozen in place, too stunned to move a single finger, let alone get up and run. Some of the black bugs ran back into Carolyn by way of her screaming mouth, but most of them hurried down her cheek and shoulder to the wet sand. Their accusing alien eyes never left Ralph as they went. "All this is your fault," the eyes seemed to say. "You could have saved her, Ralph, and a better man would have saved her." "Carolyn!" he screamed. He put his hands out to her, then pulled them back, terrified of the black bugs, which were still spewing out of her head. Behind her, Rosalie sat in her own small pocket of darkness, looking gravely at him, and now holding McGovern's misplaced chapeau in her mouth. One of Carolyn's eyes popped out and lay on the wet sand like a blob of blueberry jelly. Bugs vomited from the now empty socket. "Carolyn!" he screamed. "Carolyn! Carolyn! 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 Carolyn!" Suddenly, in the same instant that he knew the dream was over, Ralph was falling. He barely registered the fact before he thumped to the bedroom floor. He managed to break his fall with one outstretched hand, probably saving himself a nasty rap on the head, but provoking a howl of pain from beneath the butterfly bandage taped high up on his left side. For the moment, at least, he barely registered the pain. What he felt was fear, revulsion, a horrible aching grief, and most of all, an overwhelming sense of gratitude. The bad dream, surely the worst dream he'd ever had, was over, and he was in the world of real things again. He pulled back his mostly unbuttoned pajama top, checked the bandage for bleeding, saw none, and then sat up. Just doing that much seemed to exhaust him. The thought of getting up, even long enough to fall back into bed, seemed out of the question for the time being. Maybe after his panicky, racing heart slowed down a little. Can people die of bad dreams? He wondered. And in answer, he heard Joe Wise's voice. "You bet they can, Ralph. although the medical examiner usually ends up writing suicide on the cause of death line. In the shaky aftermath of his nightmare, sitting on the floor and hugging his knees with his right arm, Ralph had no real doubt that some dreams were powerful enough to kill. The details of this one were fading out now, but he could still remember the climax all too well. That thudding sound, like a hammer hitting a thick cut of beef, and the vile spew of bugs from Carolyn's head. Plump they had been, plump and lively, and why not? They'd been feasting on his dead wife's brain. Ralph uttered a low, watery moan and swiped at his face with his left hand, provoking another jolt from beneath the bandage. His palm came away slick with sweat. What exactly had she been telling him to watch out for? White man traps? No, tracks, not traps. White man tracks, whatever they were. Had there been more? Maybe, maybe not. He couldn't remember for sure, and so what? It had been a dream, for Christ's sake, just a dream. And outside of the fantasy world described in the tabloid newspapers, dreams meant nothing and proved nothing. When a person went to sleep, his mind seemed to turn into a kind of rat-house bargain hunter, sifting through the discount bins of mostly worthless short-term memories, looking not for items which were valuable or even useful, but only for things that were still bright and shiny. These it put together in freak show collages, which were often striking but had, for the most part, all a sense of Natalie Deepnose conversation. Rosalie the dog had turned up. Even Bill's missing Panama had made a cameo appearance, but it all meant nothing. Except tomorrow night he would not take one of the pain pills the EMT had given him, even if his arm felt like it was falling off. Not only had the one he'd taken during the late news failed to keep him under, as he had hoped and half expected, it had probably played its own part in causing the nightmare. Ralph managed to get up off the floor and sit on the edge of the bed. A wave of faintness floated through his head like parachute silk, and he shut his eyes until the feeling passed. While he was sitting there with his head down and his eyes closed, he groped for the lamp on the bedside table and turned it on. When he opened his eyes, the area of the bedroom lit by its warm yellow glow looked very bright and very real. He looked at the clock beside the lamp, 1:48 a.m., and he felt totally awake and totally alert, pain pill or no pain pill. He got up, walked slowly into the kitchen, and put on the tea kettle. Then he leaned against the counter, absently massaging the bandage beneath his left armpit, trying to quiet the throbbing his most recent adventures had awakened there. When the kettle steamed, he poured hot water over a bag of sleepy time. There was a joke for you. And then took the cup into the living room. He plopped into the wingback chair without bothering to turn on a light. The street lamps and the dim glow coming from the bedroom provided all he needed. Well, he thought, here I am again, front row center. Let the play begin. Time passed. Just how much he could not have said, but the throbbing beneath his arm had eased, and the tea had gone from hot to barely lukewarm, when he registered movement at the corner of his eye. Ralph turned his head, expecting to see Rosalie, but it wasn't Rosalie. It was two men stepping out onto the stoop of a house on the other side of Harris Avenue. Ralph couldn't make out the colors of the house. The orange arc sodiums the city had installed several years ago provided great visibility, but made any perception of true colors almost impossible. Yet he could see that the color of the trim was radically different from the color of the rest. That, coupled with its location, made Ralph almost positive it was May Locker's house. The two men on May Locker's stoop were very short, probably no more than 4 feet tall. They appeared to be surrounded by greenish auras. They were dressed in identical white smocks, which looked to Ralph like the ones worn by actors in those old TV doc operas, black and white melodramas like Ben Casey and Dr. Kildare. One of them had something in his hand. Ralph squinted. He couldn't make it out, but it had a sharp and hungry look. He could not have sworn under oath that it was a knife, but he thought it might be. Yes, it might very well be a knife. His first clear, evaluative thought about this experience was that the men over there looked like aliens in a movie about UFO abductions. Communion, perhaps, or fire in the sky. His second was that he had fallen asleep again, right here in his wing chair, without even noticing. That's right, Ralph. It's just a little more rummage sale action, probably brought on by the stress of being stabbed and helped along by that friggin' pain pill. He sensed nothing frightening about the two figures on May Locker's stoop, other than the long, sharp-looking thing one of them was holding. Ralph supposed that not even your dreaming mind could do much with a couple of short, bald guys wearing white tunics, which looked left over from central casting. Also, there was nothing frightening about their behavior, nothing furtive, nothing menacing. They stood on the stoop as if they had every right to be there in the darkest, stillest hour of the morning. They were facing each other, the attitudes of their bodies and large, bald heads suggesting two old friends having a sober, civilized conversation. They looked thoughtful and intelligent, the kind of space travelers who would be more apt to say, "We come in peace," than kidnap you, stick a probe up your ass, and then take notes on your reaction. All right, so maybe this new dream's not an out-and-out nightmare. After the last one, are you complaining? No, of course he wasn't. Winding up on the floor once a night was plenty, thanks. Yet there was something very disquieting about this dream, just the same. It felt real in a way that his dream of Carolyn had not. This was his own living room, after all, not some weird deserted beach he had never seen before. He was sitting in the same wing-back chair where he sat every morning, holding a cup of tea, which was now almost cold in his left hand. And when he raised the fingers of his right hand to his nose, as he was doing now, he could still smell a faint whiff of soap beneath the nails, the Irish Spring he liked to use in the shower. Ralph suddenly reached beneath his left armpit and pressed his fingers to the bandage there. The pain was immediate and intense, but the two small bald men in the white tunics stayed right where they were, on May Locker's doorstep. "It doesn't matter what you think you feel, Ralph. It can't matter, because..." "Fuck you," Ralph said in a hoarse, low voice. He rose from the wing chair, putting his cup down on the little table beside it as he did. Sleepy time slopped onto the TV guide there. "Fuck you. This is no dream." He hurried across the living room to the kitchen, pajamas flapping, old worn slippers scuffing and thumping. The place where Charlie Pickering had stuck him, sending out hot little bursts of pain. He grabbed the chair and took it into the apartment's small foyer. There was a closet here. Ralph opened its door, snapped on the light just inside, positioned the chair so he would be able to reach the closet's top shelf, and then stood on it. The shelf was a clutter of lost or forgotten items, most of which had belonged to Carolyn. These were small things, little more than scraps, but looking at them drove away the last lingering conviction that this had to be a dream. There was an ancient bag of M&Ms, her secret snack food, her comfort food. There was a lace heart, a single discarded white satin pump with a broken heel, a photo album. These things hurt a lot more than the knife prick under his arm, but he had no time to hurt just now. Ralph leaned forward, placing his left hand on the high, dusty shelf to balance his weight, then began to shuffle through the junk with his right hand, all the while praying that the kitchen chair wouldn't take a notion to scoot out from under him. The wound below his armpit was now throbbing outrageously, and he knew he was going to get it bleeding again if he didn't stop the athletics soon, but... "I'm sure they're up here somewhere." Well, almost sure. He pushed aside his old fly box and his wicker creel. There was a stack of magazines behind the creel. The one on top was an issue of Look, with Andy Williams on the cover. Ralph shoved them aside with the heel of his hand, sending up a flurry of dust. The old bag of M&Ms fell to the floor and split open, spraying brightly colored bits of candy in every direction. Ralph leaned even farther forward, now almost on his toes. He supposed it was his imagination, but he thought he could sense the kitchen chair he was on getting ready to be evil. The thought had no more than crossed his mind when the chair squawked and began to slide slowly backward on the hardwood floor. Ralph ignored that, ignored his throbbing side, and ignored the voice telling him he ought to stop this. He really ought to, because he was dreaming awake, just as the Hall book said many insomniacs eventually did. And although those little fellows across the street didn't really exist, he could really be standing here on this slowly sliding chair, and he could really break his hip when it went out from under him. And just how the hell was he going to explain what had happened when some smart-ass doctor in the emergency room of Derry Home asked him? Grunting, he reached all the way back, pushed aside a carton from which half a Christmas tree star protruded like a strange spiky periscope, knocking the heelless evening pump to the floor in the process, and saw what he wanted in the far left-hand corner of the shelf, the case which contained his old Zeiss Icon binoculars. Ralph stepped off the chair just before it could slide all the way out from under him, moved it closer in, then got up on it again. He couldn't reach all the way into the corner where the binocular case stood, so he grabbed the trout net, which had been lying up here next to his creel and fly box for lo these many years, and succeeded in bagging the case on his second try. He dragged it forward until he could grab the strap, stepped off the chair, and came down on the fallen evening pump. His ankle twisted painfully. Ralph staggered, flailed his arms for balance, and managed to avoid going face first into the wall. As he started back into the living room, however, he felt liquid warmth beneath the bandage on his side. He had managed to open the knife wound again after all. Wonderful. Just a wonderful night, Shea Roberts. And how long had he been away from the window? He didn't know, but it felt like a long time, and he was sure the little bald doctors would be gone when he got back there. The street would be empty, and he stopped dead, the binocular case dangling at the end of its strap and tracking a long, slow, trapezoidal shadow back and forth across the floor, where the orange glow of the streetlights lay like an ugly coat of paint. Little bald doctors? Was that how he had just thought of them? Yes, of course, because that was what they called them. The folks who claimed to have been abducted by them, examined by them, operated on by them in some cases. They were physicians from space, proctologists from the great beyond. But that wasn't the big deal. The big deal was... Ted used the phrase, Ralph thought. He used it the night he called me and warned me to stay away from him and his interests. He said it was the doctor who told him about the Crimson King and the Centurion and all the rest. Yes, Ralph whispered. His back was prickling madly with goose flesh. Yes, that's what he said. The doctor told me, the little bald doctor. When he reached the window, he saw that the strangers were still out there, although they had moved from May Locker's stoop to the sidewalk while he had been fishing for the binoculars. They were standing directly beneath one of those damned orange streetlights, in fact. Ralph's feeling that Harris Avenue looked like a deserted stage set after the evening performance returned with weird declamatory force, but with a different significance. For one thing, the set was no longer deserted, was it? Some ominous, long-past-midnight play had commenced in what the two odd creatures below no doubt assumed was a totally empty theater. What would they do if they knew they had an audience, Ralph wondered. What would they do to me? The bald doctors now had the shared demeanor of men who have nearly reached agreement. In that instant, they did not look like doctors at all to Ralph, in spite of their smocks. They looked like blue-collar workers coming off shift at some plant or factory. These two guys, clearly buddies, have stopped outside the main gate for a moment or two to finish off some subject that can't wait even long enough for them to walk down the block to the nearest bar, knowing it will only take a minute or so in any case. Total agreement is only a conversational exchange or two away. Ralph uncased the binoculars, raised them to his eyes, and wasted a moment or two in puzzled fiddling with a focus knob before realizing he had forgotten to take off the lens caps. He did so, then raised the glasses again. This time the two figures standing under the street lamp jumped into his field of vision at once, large and perfectly lit, but fuzzed out. He turned the little knob between the barrels again, and the two men popped into focus almost immediately. Ralph's breath stopped in his throat. The look he got was extremely brief. No more than 3 seconds passed before one of the men, if they were men, nodded and clapped a hand on his companion's shoulder. Then they both turned away, leaving Ralph with nothing to look at but their bald heads and smooth, white-clad backs. Only 3 seconds at most, but Ralph saw enough in that brief space of time to make him profoundly uneasy. He had run to get the binoculars for two reasons, both predicated on his inability to go on believing that this was a dream. First, he wanted to be sure he could identify the two men if he was ever called upon to do so. Second, this one was less admissible to his conscious mind, but every bit as urgent, he had wanted to dispel the unsettling notion that he was having his own close encounter of the third kind. Instead of dispelling it, his brief look through the binoculars intensified it. The little bald doctors did not actually seem to have features. They had faces, yes, eyes, noses, mouths, but they seemed as interchangeable as the chrome trim on the same make and model of a car. They could have been identical twins, but that wasn't the impression Ralph got either. To him, they looked more like department store mannequins, with their Arnell wigs whisked off for the night, their eerie resemblance not the result of genetics, but of mass production. The only peculiar quality he could isolate and name was the preternaturally smooth quality of their skin. Neither of them had so much as a single visible line or wrinkle. No moles, blotches, or scars either, although Ralph supposed those were things you might miss with even a great pair of binoculars. Beyond the smooth and strangely line-free quality of their skin, everything became subjective. And his only look had been so goddamn brief. If he had been able to get to the binoculars more quickly, without the rigmarole of the chair and the fishing net, and if he had realized that the lens caps were on right away, instead of wasting more time fiddling with a focusing knob, he might have saved himself some or all of the unease he was now feeling. "They look sketched," he thought in the instant before they turned their backs on him. "That's what's really bothering me, I think. Not the identical bald heads, the identical white smocks, or even the lack of wrinkles. It's how they look sketched. The eyes just circles, the small pink ears just squiggles made with a felt-tip pen. The mouth is a pair of quick, almost careless strokes of pale pink watercolor. They don't really look like either people or aliens. They look like hasty representations of, well, I don't know what." He was sure of one thing. Docs number one and number two were both immersed in bright auras, which in the binoculars appeared to be green gold and filled with deep reddish-orange flecks that looked like sparks swirling up from a campfire. These auras conveyed a feeling of power and vitality to Ralph that their featureless, uninteresting faces did not. The faces? I'm not sure I could pick them out again, even if someone held a gun to my head. It's as if they were made to be forgotten. If they were still bald, sure, no problem. But if they were wearing wigs and maybe sitting down, so I couldn't see how short they are? Maybe. The lack of lines might do the trick. But then again, maybe not. The auras, though, those green-gold auras with the red flecks swirling through them, I'd know them anywhere. But there's something wrong with them, isn't there? What is it? The answer popped into Ralph's mind as suddenly and easily as the two creatures had popped into view when he had finally remembered to remove the lens caps from the binoculars. Both of the little doctors were swaddled in brilliant auras, but neither had a balloon string floating up from his hairless head. Not even a sign of one. They went strolling down Harris Avenue in the direction of Strawford Park, moving with the ease of two friends out for a Sunday stroll. Just before they left the bright circle of light thrown by the street lamp in front of May Locker's house, Ralph dropped the angle of the binoculars so they picked up the item in Doc Number One's right hand. It wasn't a knife, as he had surmised, but it still wasn't the sort of object you felt comfortable seeing in the hand of a departing stranger in the wee hours of the morning.
It was a pair of long-bladed stainless steel scissors. That sense of being pushed relentlessly toward the mouth of a tunnel where all sorts of unpleasant things were waiting was with him again. Only now it was accompanied by a feeling of panic, because it seemed that the latest big shove had taken place while he had been asleep and dreaming of his dead wife. Something inside him wanted to shriek with terror, and Ralph understood that if he didn't do something to soothe it immediately, he would soon be shrieking out loud. He closed his eyes and began to take deep breaths, trying to picture a different item of food with each one. A tomato, a potato, an ice cream sandwich, a Brussels sprout. Dr. Jamal had taught Carolyn this simple relaxation technique, and it had frequently staved off her headaches before they could get up a full head of steam. Even in the last 6 weeks, when the tumor had been out of control, the technique had sometimes worked, and it controlled Ralph's panic now. His heartbeat began to slow, and that feeling that he needed to scream began to pass. Continuing to take deep breaths and to think, apple, pear, slice of lemon pie, of food, Ralph carefully snapped the lens caps back on the binoculars. His hands were still trembling, but not so badly he couldn't use them. Once the binoculars were capped and returned to their case, Ralph gingerly raised his left arm and looked at the bandage. There was a red spot in the center of it, the size of an aspirin tablet, but it did not appear to be spreading. Good. There isn't anything good about this, Ralph. Fair enough, but that wasn't going to help him decide exactly what had happened, or what he was going to do about it. Step one was to push his dreadful dream of Carolyn to one side for the time being, and decide what had actually happened. "I've been awake ever since I hit the floor," Ralph told the empty room. "I know that, and I know I saw those men." Yes, he had really seen them, and the green-gold auras around them. He wasn't alone, either. Ed Deepnow had seen at least one of them, too. Ralph would have bet the farm on it, if he'd had a farm to bet. It didn't ease his mind much, however, to know that he and the wife-beating paranoid from up the street were seeing the same little bald guys. And the auras, Ralph. Didn't he say something about those two? Well, he hadn't used that exact word, but Ralph was quite sure he had spoken of the auras at least twice, just the same. Ralph, sometimes the world is full of colors. That had been August, shortly before John Lydecker had arrested Ed on a charge of domestic abuse, a misdemeanor. Then almost a month later, when he had called Ralph on the phone. "Are you seeing the colors yet?" First the colors, now the little bald doctors. Surely the Crimson King himself would be along any time. And all that aside, what was he supposed to do about what he had just seen? The answer came in an unexpected but welcome burst of clarity. The issue he saw was not his own sanity, not the auras, not the little bald doctors, but May Locker. He had just seen two strangers step out of Mrs. Locker's house in the dead of night, and one of them had been carrying a potentially lethal weapon. Ralph reached past the cased binoculars, took the telephone, and dialed 911. "This is Officer Hagen," a woman's voice. "How may I help you?" "By listening carefully and acting fast," Ralph said crisply. The look of dazed indecision which he had worn so frequently since midsummer was gone now. Sitting erect in the wing-back chair with a phone in his lap, he looked not 70, but a healthy and capable 55. "You may be able to save a woman's life."
"Sir, would you please give me your name and..."
"Don't interrupt me, please, Officer Hagen," said the man who could no longer remember the last four digits of the Derry Cinema Center. "I woke up a short time ago, couldn't go back to sleep, and decided to sit up for a while. My living room looks out on Upper Harris Avenue. I just saw..." Here Ralph paused for the barest moment, thinking not about what he had seen, but what he wanted to tell Officer Hagen he had seen. The answer came as quickly and effortlessly as the decision to call 911 in the first place. "I saw two men coming out of a house up the street from the Red Apple store. The house belongs to a woman named May Locker." "That's L-O-C-H-E-R. First letter L, as in Lexington. Mrs. Locker is severely ill. I've never seen these two men before. He paused again, but this time consciously, wanting to achieve maximum effect. One of them had a pair of scissors in his hand. "Site address?" Officer Hagen asked. She was calm enough, but Ralph sensed he had turned on a lot of her lights. "I don't know," he said. "Get it out of the phone book, Officer Hagen. Or just tell the responding officers to look for the yellow house with a pink trim half a block or so up from the Red Apple. They'll probably have to use a flashlight to pick it out because of the damned orange streetlights, but they'll find it."
"Yes, sir, I'm sure they will. But I still need your name and telephone number for our rec..."
Ralph replaced the phone gently in its cradle. He sat looking at it for almost a full minute, expecting it to ring. When it didn't, he decided they either didn't have the fancy traceback equipment he saw on the TV true crime shows, or it hadn't been turned on. That was good. It didn't solve the problem of what he was going to do or say if they hauled May Locker out of a hideous yellow and pink house in pieces, but it did buy a little more thinking time. Below, Harris Avenue remained still and silent, lit only by the high-intensity lamps, which marched off in both directions like some surrealist dream of perspective. The play, short but full of drama, appeared to be over. The stage was empty again. Not quite empty after all. Rosalie came limping out of the alley between the Red Apple and the True Value Hardware next door. The faded bandana flapped around her neck. This wasn't a Thursday. There were no garbage cans set out for Rosalie to investigate, and she moved briskly up the sidewalk until she got to May Locker's house. There she stopped and lowered her nose, looking at that long and rather pretty nose. Ralph had thought on occasion that there must be a collie somewhere in Rosalie's woodpile. Something was glimmering there, Ralph realized. He got the binoculars out of their case once more and trained them on Rosalie. As he did, he found his mind returning to September 10th again, this time to his meeting with Bill and Lois just outside the entrance to Strawford Park. He remembered how Bill had put his arm around Lois's waist and led her up the street, how the two of them together had made Ralph think of Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire. Most of all, he remembered the spectral tracks the two of them had left behind. Lois's had been gray, Bill's olive green. Hallucinations, he had thought them at the time, back in the good old days before he started attracting the attention of nuts like Charlie Pickering and seeing little bald doctors in the middle of the night. Rosalie was sniffing at a similar track. It was the same green gold as the auras which had surrounded bald doc number one and bald doc number two. Ralph panned the binoculars slowly away from the dog and saw more tracks, two sets of them, leading down the sidewalk in the direction of the park. They were fading. He could almost see them fading as he looked at them, but they were there. Ralph panned the binoculars back to Rosalie, suddenly feeling an enormous wave of affection for the mangy old stray. And why not? If he had needed final, absolute proof that he had actually seen the things he thought he had seen, Rosalie was it. If baby Natalie was here, she'd see them too, Ralph thought. And then all his doubts tried to crowd back in. Would she? Would she really? He thought he had seen the baby grab at the faint auras left by his fingers, and he had been sure she was gawking at the spectral green smoke sizzling off the flowers in the kitchen. But how could he be sure? How could anyone be sure what a baby was looking at or reaching for? But Rosalie, look, right down there, see her? The only trouble with that, Ralph realized, was that he hadn't seen the tracks until Rosalie had begun to sniff the sidewalk. Maybe she was sniffing at an entrancing remnant of leftover postman, and what he was seeing had been created by nothing more than his tired, sleep-starved mind, like the little bald doctors themselves. In the magnified field of the binoculars, Rosalie now began to make her way down Harris Avenue with her nose to the sidewalk and her ragged tail waving slowly back and forth. She was moving from the green-gold tracks left by Doc Number One to those left by Doc Number Two, and then back to Doc Number One's trail again. "So now, why don't you tell me what that stray bitch is following, Ralph? Do you think it's possible for a dog to track a fucking hallucination? It's not a hallucination. It's tracks. Real tracks. The white man tracks that Carolyn told you to watch out for. You know that. You see that. It's crazy, though, he told himself. Crazy. But was it? Was it really? The dream might have been more than a dream. If there was such a thing as hyper-reality, and he could now testify that there was, then maybe there was such a thing as precognition, too. Or ghosts which came in dreams and foretold the future. Who knew? It was as if a door in the wall of reality had come ajar, and now all sorts of unwelcome things were flying through. Of one thing he was sure, the tracks were really there. He saw them. Rosalie smelled them. And that was all there was to it. Ralph had discovered a number of strange and interesting things during his 6 months of premature waking. And one of them was that a human being's capacity for self-deception seemed to be at its lowest ebb between 3 and 6 in the morning. And it was now... Ralph leaned forward so he could see the clock on the kitchen wall. Just past 3:30. Uh-huh. He raised the binoculars again and saw Rosalie still moving up the Ball Dock's back trail. If someone came strolling along Harris Avenue right now, unlikely given the hour, but not impossible, they would see nothing but a stray mutt with a dirty coat, sniffing at the sidewalk in the aimless fashion of untrained, unowned dogs everywhere. Ralph could see what Rosalie was sniffing at, and had finally given himself permission to believe his eyes. It was a permission he might revoke once the sun was up, but for now he knew exactly what he was seeing. Rosalie's head came up suddenly, her ears cocked forward. For one moment she was almost beautiful, the way a hunting dog on point is beautiful. Then, moments before the headlights of a car approaching the Harris Avenue Witcham Street intersection splashed the street, she was gone back the way she had come, running in a corkscrewing, limping gait that made Ralph feel sorry for her. When you came right down to it, what was Rosalie but another Harris Avenue old crock, one that didn't even have the comfort of the occasional game of gin rummy or penny ante poker with others of her kind? She darted back into the alley between the Red Apple and the hardware store an instant before a Derry police cruiser turned the corner and floated slowly up the street. Its siren was off, but the revolving flashes were on. They painted the sleeping houses and small businesses ranged along this part of Harris Avenue with alternating pulses of red and blue light. Ralph put the binoculars back in his lap and leaned forward in the wing chair, forearms on his thighs, watching intently. His heart was beating hard enough for him to be able to feel it in his temples. The cruiser slowed to a crawl as it passed the Red Apple. The spotlight mounted on its right-hand side snapped on, and the beam began to slide across the fronts of the sleeping houses on the far side of the street. In most cases, it also slid across the street numbers mounted beside doors or on porch columns. When it lit on the number of May Locker's house, 86, Ralph saw, and he didn't need the binoculars to read it either, the cruiser's taillights flashed and the car came to a stop. 2 uniformed policemen got out and approached the walk leading up to the house, oblivious of both the man watching from a darkened second-floor window across the street and the fading green-gold footprints over which they were walking. They conferred, and Ralph raised the binoculars again to get a closer look. He was almost positive that the younger of the two men was the uniformed cop who had shown up with Lydecker at Ed's house on the day Ed had been arrested. Noel. Had that been his name?
No, Ralph murmured.
Nell. Chris Nell. Or maybe it was Jess. Nell and his partner seemed to be having a serious discussion about something. Much more serious than the one the little ball doctors had been having before they strolled away. This one ended with the cops drawing their sidearms and then climbing the narrow steps to Mrs. Locker's stoop in single file, with Nell in front. He pressed the doorbell, waited, then pressed it again. This time he leaned on the button for a good 5 seconds. They waited a little more, and then the second cop brushed past Nell and had a go at the button himself. Maybe that one knows the secret art of doorbell ringing, Ralph thought. Probably learned it by answering a Rosicrucian's ad. If so, the technique failed him this time. There was still no response, and Ralph wasn't surprised. Strange bald men with scissors notwithstanding, he doubted May Locker could even get out of bed. But if she's bedridden, she might have a companion, someone to get her her meals, help her to the toilet, or give her the bedpan. Chris Nell, or maybe it was Jess, stepped up to the plate again. This time he forewent the doorbell in favor of the old wham, 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 open in the name of the law technique. He used his left fist to do this. He was still holding his gun in his right, the barrel pressed against the leg of his uniform pants. A terrible image, every bit as clear and persuasive as the auras he had been seeing, suddenly filled Ralph's mind. He saw a woman lying in bed with a clear plastic oxygen mask over her mouth and nose. Above the mask, her glazed eyes bulged sightlessly from their sockets. Below it, her throat had been opened in a wide, ragged smile. The bedclothes and the bosom of the woman's nightgown were drenched with blood. Not far away, lying on the floor, was the face-down corpse of another woman, the companion. Marching up the back of this second woman's pink flannel nightgown were half a dozen stab wounds, made by the points of Doc Number One's scissors. And Ralph knew, if you raised the nightgown for a closer look, each would look a lot like the wound under his own arm, like the sort of oversized period made by children just learning to print. Ralph tried to blink the grisly vision away. It wouldn't go. He felt dull pain in his hands and saw he had closed them into tight fists. The nails were digging into his palms. He forced his hands open and clamped them on his thighs. Now the eye in his mind saw the woman in the pink nightgown twitching slightly. She was still alive, but maybe not for long. Almost certainly not for long, unless these two oafs decided to try something a little more productive than just standing on the stoop and taking turns knocking or jazzing the doorbell. "Come on, you guys," Ralph said, squeezing at his thighs. "Come on, come on. Let's get with it. What do you say?" "You know the things you're seeing are all in your head, don't you?" he asked himself uneasily. "I mean, there might be a couple of women lying dead over there. Sure, there might be. But you don't know that, right? It's not like the auras or the tracks." No, it wasn't like the auras or the tracks. And yes, he did know that. He also knew that no one was answering the door over there at 86 Harris Avenue. And that did not bode well for Bill McGovern's old Cardville schoolmate. He hadn't seen any blood on the scissors in Doc Number One's hand. But given the iffy quality of the old Zeiss Icon binocs, that didn't prove much. Also, the guy could have wiped them clean before leaving the house. The thought had no more than crossed Ralph's mind before his imagination added a bloody hand towel lying beside the dead companion in the pink nightgown. "Come on, you two," Ralph cried in a low voice. "Jesus Christ, you're going to stand there all night?" More headlights splashed up Harris Avenue. The new arrival was an unmarked Ford sedan with a flashing red dashboard bubble. The man who got out was wearing plain clothes, gray poplin windbreaker and blue knitted watch cap. Ralph had maintained momentary hopes that the newcomer would turn out to be John Lydecker, even though Lydecker had told him he wouldn't be coming on until noon. But he didn't have to check with the binoculars to make sure it wasn't. This man was much slimmer and wearing a dark mustache. Cop number two went down the walk to meet him, while Chris, or Jess Nell, went around the corner of Mrs. Locker's house. One of those pauses which the movie so conveniently edited out then ensued. Cop number two reholstered his gun. He and the newly arrived detective stood at the foot of Mrs. Locker's stoop, apparently talking, and glancing at the closed door every now and then. Once, the uniformed cop took a step or two in the direction Nell had gone. The detective reached out, grasped his arm, detained him. They talked some more. Ralph clutched his upper thighs tighter and made a small, frustrated noise in his throat. A few minutes crawled by, and then everything happened at once in that confusing, overlapping, inconclusive way with which emergency situations seem to develop. Another police car arrived. Mrs. Locker's house and those neighboring it on the right and left were now bathed in streaks of conflicting red and yellow light.
Two more uniformed cops got out of it, opened the trunk, and removed a bulky contraption that looked to Ralph like a portable torture device. He believed this gadget was known as the Jaws of Life. Following the huge storm in the spring of 1985, a storm which had resulted in the deaths of more than 200 people, many of whom had been trapped and drowned in their cars, Derry's schoolchildren had mounted a penny drive to buy one. As the two new cops were carrying the Jaws of Life across the sidewalk, the front door of the house on the uphill side of Mrs. Locker's opened, and the Eberleys, Stan and Georgina, stepped out onto their stoop. They wore matching his and her bathrobes, and Stan's gray hair was standing up in wild tufts that made Ralph think of Charlie Pickering. He raised the binoculars, scanned their curious, excited faces briefly, then put them back in his lap again. The next vehicle to appear was an ambulance from Derry Home Hospital. Like the police cars, which had already arrived, its howler was off, in deference to the hour. But it had a full roof rack of red lights, and they were strobing wildly. To Ralph, the developments across the street looked like a scene from one of his beloved Dirty Harry movies, only with the sound turned off. The two cops got the Jaws of Life halfway across the lawn and then dropped it. The detective in the windbreaker and the watch cap turned to them and raised his hands to shoulder level, palms out as if to say, "What did you think you were going to do with that thing? Break down the goddamn door with it?" At the same second, Officer Nell came back around the house. He was shaking his head. The detective in the watch cap abruptly turned, brushed past Nell and his partner, mounted the steps, raised one foot, and kicked in May Locker's front door. He paused to unzip his jacket, probably to free access to his gun, and then walked in without looking back. Ralph felt like applauding. Nell and his partner looked at each other uncertainly, then followed the detective up the steps and through the door. Ralph leaned forward even farther in his chair, now close enough to the window for his nostrils to make little fog roses on the glass. Three men, their white hospital pants looking orange in the glare of the high-intensity street lamps, got out of the ambulance. One of them opened the rear doors, and then all three of them simply stood there, hands in jacket pockets, waiting to see if they would be needed. The two cops who had carried the Jaws of Life halfway across Mrs. Locker's lawn looked at each other, shrugged, picked it up, and began carrying it back toward their cruiser again. There were several large divots in the lawn where they had dropped it. "Just let her be okay, that's all," Ralph thought. "Just let her and anyone who was in the house with her be okay." The detective appeared in the doorway again, and Ralph's heart sank as he motioned to the men standing at the rear of the ambulance. Two of them removed the stretcher with a collapsible undercarriage. The third remained where he was. The men with the stretcher went up the walk and into the house at a smart pace, but they did not run. And when the orderly who had remained behind produced a pack of cigarettes and lit one, Ralph knew, suddenly, completely, and with no doubts, that May Locker was dead. Stan and Georgina Eberly walked to the low line of hedge which separated their front yard from Mrs. Locker's. They had put their arms around each other's waist, and to Ralph they looked like the Bobbsey twins, grown old and fat and frightened. Other neighbors were also coming out, either awakened by the silent convergence of emergency lights or because the telephone network along this little stretch of Harris Avenue was already beginning to operate. Most of the people Ralph saw were old. "We golden ages," Bill McGovern liked to call them, always with that small satirical lift of the eyebrow, of course. Men and women whose rest was fragile and easily broken at the best of times. He suddenly realized that Ed, Helen, and baby Natalie had been the youngest people between here and the extension, and now the Deep Nose were gone. "I could go down there," he thought. "I'd fit right in. Just another one of Bill's golden ages." Except he couldn't. His legs felt like bunches of tea bags held together by weak twists of string, and he was quite sure that if he tried to get up, he would go flopping bonelessly to the floor. So he sat and watched from his window, watched the play develop below him on the stage, which had always been empty at this hour before, except for the occasional walk-through by Rosalie, that was. It was a play he had produced himself, with a single anonymous telephone call. He watched the orderlies re-emerge with the stretcher, this time moving more slowly because of the sheeted figure which had been strapped to it. Warring streaks of blue and red light flickered over that sheet, and the shapes of legs, hips, arms, neck, and head beneath it. Ralph was suddenly plunged back into his dream. He saw his wife under the sheet, not May Locker, but Carolyn Roberts. And at any moment her head would split open, and the black bugs, the ones which had grown fat on the meat of her diseased brain, would begin to boil out. Ralph raised the heels of his palms to his eyes. Some sound, some inarticulate sound of grief and rage, horror and weariness, escaped him. He sat that way for a long time, wishing he had never seen any of this, and hoping blindly that if there really was a tunnel, he would not be required to enter it after all. The auras were strange and beautiful, but there was not enough beauty in all of them to make up for one moment of that terrible dream in which he had discovered his wife buried below the high tide line. Not enough beauty to make up for the dreary horror of his lost, wakeful nights, or the sight of that sheeted figure being rolled out of the house across the street. It was a lot more than just wishing that the play was over. As he sat there with the heels of his palms pressing against the lids of his closed eyes, he wanted all of it to be over. All of it. For the first time in his 25,000 days of life, Ralph Roberts found himself wishing he were dead.